content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the September 14th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. He's on a track, and it looks like he's actually running the hurdles, going real fast, going over a hurdle actually at the moment. He's got a briefcase in each hand, and they're both slightly ajar with papers flying everywhere, very determined look on his face. And the title is Obstacle Course, the bitter fight to block Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination. And that is the main story that we will start with right now. Turbulent confirmation hearings for Kavanaugh. What happened? President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, faced one of the most contentious confirmation hearings in Senate history this week. With his vote expected to give conservatives the power to shape American law for decades to come, Kavanaugh avoided giving direct answers to most of the pointed questions from Democrats, insisting that he will serve as an independent-minded justice. Kavanaugh declined to say whether Roe v. Wade, which established the constitutional right to have an abortion, was properly decided, saying only that justices are bound to take the court's precedents into account, and if a sitting president should be required to respond to a subpoena, or if President Trump can pardon himself for crimes. Kavanaugh said he could not answer hypothetical questions about cases that might come before him. The person with the best arguments on the law is the person that will win with me, Kavanaugh said. Democrats tried unsuccessfully to postpone the hearing altogether, demanding more time to review 42,000 pages of confidential documents from Kavanaugh's work with George W. Bush's White House, released the day before hearings began. The Trump administration has refused to release more than 100,000 additional pages of documents on the grounds of executive privilege. Democrats pressed Republican Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley to adjourn while protesters shouted anti-Kavanaugh slogans from the gallery. This is the most incomplete, most partisan, least transparent vetting for any Supreme Court nominee I have ever seen, said Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont. What the editorial said, Democrats have descended into histrionics in their crusade to block Kavanaugh, said the Wall Street Journal. The Senate has already received more than 500,000 pages of documents related to Kavanaugh's time as a lawyer and a judge, more than the last five nominees combined. Kavanaugh also has a lengthy record of 307 written opinions as a federal judge. Rather than showing him as some kind of Trumpian monster, they demonstrate that he's the kind of mainstream legal conservative that any GOP president would have had on his short list. There is no good excuse not to thoroughly vet a lifetime appointee to the country's highest court, said the Washington Post. Only a small fraction of the documents made available come from Kavanaugh's years as White House staff secretary to President George W. Bush, a controversial period Kavanaugh says shaped his judicial views more than any other. The Republicans' rush to confirm him will leave many Americans wondering, with reason, what they are not being told, what the columnist said. Kavanaugh's deliberately vague answers on abortion tell us nothing, said Anna North in Vox.com. In the past, he's praised the dissent on Roe and made his anti-abortion sentiments clear. His mealy-mouthed talk about precedent is just a smokescreen to give Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, the two pro-choice Republicans, enough cover to vote for his confirmation and give him the necessary 51 votes. Democrats have picked the wrong enemy, said David French in NationalReview.com. Kavanaugh represents the values those attending John McCain's funeral this week claim they miss in the age of Trump. But liberals have turned his hearing into a disgusting spectacle filled with rude interruptions from senators, hamming it up for the hashtag resistance, and shrieking protesters dressed in outfits from The Handmaid's Tale. This is why conservatives don't believe for one moment that Donald Trump is the sole source of American dysfunction. A single seat on the Supreme Court shouldn't be this important, said David Kaplan in the New York Times. If the justices' votes can be predicted based on the president who appoints them, then what's the point of having a court that, in theory, operates above politics? When justices rule the way we like, we laud them for correctly interpreting the Constitution. When they rule against us, we accuse them of legislating from the bench. In the fight for the court, hypocrisy is king. Our controversy of the week, Pope Francis, the Catholic Church's Civil War. Just when it seemed the news couldn't get more troubling for American Catholics, said James Downey in WashingtonPost.com, they have been hit with another hammer blow. On the heels of the horrific revelations about the widespread organized rape of children by priests in Pennsylvania and the church's ensuing cover-ups, Pope Francis himself has now been credibly accused of enabling an abuser. In an 11-page testimony sent to Catholic publications, Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano says that in 2013, he personally informed Francis of a dossier this thick, full of allegations that prominent U.S. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick had sexually harassed and abused young male seminarians. Vigano further claims that Pope Benedict XVI, Francis' predecessor, had sanctioned McCarrick, ordering him to withdraw to a life of prayer and penance, but that Francis later lifted those sanctions, removing McCarrick from the ministry only this summer when a 45-year-old claim of child abuse was substantiated. So far, Francis' only comment is that Vigano's letter speaks for itself, said Robert George in the Wall Street Journal. But Catholics deserve answers. If Francis turned a blind eye to McCarrick's grave sexual offenses for at least 5 years, then the papacy must end. Let's not rush to judgment, said Michael O'Loughlin in NewRepublic.com. Vigano's claim that Benedict imposed sanctions on McCarrick that Francis ignored is shaky at best. During the time of his supposed ban, McCarrick continued to make public appearances, and Benedict reportedly remembers issuing no formal decree, just a private request to McCarrick. In addition, Vigano clearly has an ulterior motive for his attack on Francis. He's a central figure in the church's conservative wing, which has been appalled by Francis' effort to modernize the church, including his focus on social justice and climate change, and most of all, his relatively more progressive views on homosexuality. This is nothing less than an attempted coup by Vigano and other members of his ultra-conservative cabal, said Timothy Egan in the New York Times. The old guard was infuriated when Francis said of gay Catholics, "Who am I to judge?" And when he opened the door to divorce Catholics receiving communion. The conservatives think that linking Francis to the child abuse scandal is their best shot at bringing him down. Yes, but is it true? Asked Elizabeth Brunig in WashingtonPost.com. Vigano is alleging a series of official communications by two successive popes, and Francis owes it to Catholics to release all relevant documents so we can learn the truth. Instead, said Warren Henry in TheFederalist.com, Francis and his fawning handmaidens in the media are trying to ride out this scandal using Bill Clinton's playbook from the 1990s. They have already demonized his accuser, Vigano, and alleged a vast right-wing conspiracy. Now some are even arguing that because McCarrick primarily had sex with seminarians over 18, it was consensual, so there was no crime for Francis to have covered up. Let's talk about actual crimes then, said Lily Loofborough in Slate.com. What's more important, the palace intrigue over what Vigano may or may not have told Francis in 2013, or the boys whom priests in Pennsylvania marked with special gold crosses to signal to other clerical predators they'd been groomed for additional abuse, or the 7-year-old girl a priest raped while she was in the hospital, or tens of thousands of children worldwide abused by priests? Finding out what Pope Francis knew or didn't know about Cardinal McCarrick won't cure what ails the Catholic Church. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for getting rich, with the publication of a new study suggesting that, contrary to conventional wisdom, winning the lottery actually does improve people's lives. The survey of 3,362 lottery winners found that even decades after striking it rich, winners were still reporting increased life satisfaction and improved mental health. It was a good week for cocktail hour, after a new study found that couples who drink moderate amounts of alcohol together have better relationships. Regular drinking with one's partner decreases negative marital quality over time, the study author says, with the reported effects being significantly greater among wives. And it was a good week for returning home, after the FBI announced that it had recovered the iconic ruby slippers that were worn by Judy Garland in 1939's The Wizard of Oz, stolen from a Minnesota museum 13 years ago. But it was a bad week for filial pride, after Jessica Manafort, the daughter of President Trump's jailed former campaign manager, filed paperwork to legally change her last name. I would like my new name to be Jessica Ann Bond, the 36-year-old filmmaker and self-described passionate liberal said, explaining that it more closely suits my profession. It was a bad week for bros, after an 18-wheel truck containing a load of Axe body spray exploded while driving on a highway near Belton, Texas, turning the highway surface into pulverized, fragrant gravel. And it was a bad week for Gwyneth Paltrow, whose wellness brand Goop agreed to pay $145,000 to settle a state of California lawsuit accusing the company of claiming that its quartz and jade vaginal eggs could boost orgasms and increase feminine energy, or Yoni. And while we're here, a boring but important item. White House blocks federal pay raises. President Trump canceled cost of living raises for nearly 2 million civilian workers. In a letter to congressional leaders, the president said the U.S. could not afford next year's scheduled 2.1% salary increase. Congress has the power to override the president's decision and issue federal pay raises through legislation. The Senate has backed a 1.9% raise, but House Republicans have followed Trump on the pay freeze. Even some consistent allies pushed back. Virginia Representative Barbara Comstock, a Republican running in a district with many federal workers, was among several D.C. area Republicans who opposed the move. We cannot balance the budget, Comstock said, on the backs of our federal employees. Our briefing page article this week is titled Afghanistan, the Endless War. The U.S. war in the graveyard of empires has lasted nearly 17 years. Will it ever end? What's the country like now? Afghanistan has changed a great deal since the U.S.-led coalition first invaded in December 2001 to topple a Taliban government that had given safe haven to al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The population of Kabul has shot up from 1.5 million then to almost 6 million now, and that's bad news for the Taliban because cosmopolitan urbanites are much less likely than rural peasants to submit to the Taliban's harsh form of Sunni Islam. Women, ruthlessly oppressed under the Taliban, are now freer, at least in Kabul. Still, the war is everywhere, and the Taliban are on the offensive. The government controls the cities and about 60% of the country overall. The rest is either contested or under Taliban control, which means the Taliban now rule more territory than they have at any time since 2001. And the Taliban have stepped up attacks this year, possibly in preparation for talks, so they can negotiate from strength. Just last month, the Taliban laid siege to the southeastern city of Ghazni for days, killing hundreds of Afghan soldiers and civilians. How many U.S. troops are there? When President Obama took office, there were 30,000 U.S. troops. His surge more than tripled the force to more than 100,000 at its peak in 2011 in the hope that a decisive blow would bring victory. But the Taliban knew Obama intended to withdraw the troops soon and waited him out in safe havens in Pakistan. President Trump entered office deeply skeptical of the war, but the military persuaded him to continue supporting the Afghan army. Reluctantly, Trump boosted forces from 8,400 when he took office to nearly 15,000 now. On an open-ended mission, and he eased restrictions on the use of armed drones and airstrikes. "We will fight to win," Trump pledged last year. But 15,000 U.S. troops can't defeat the Taliban. They're fighting merely to keep the Afghan forces from collapsing. Those Afghan forces number about 300,000 at varying levels of training, but there is frequent desertion and they suffer heavy losses. In 2016, nearly 7,000 soldiers and police were killed, and then the government stopped releasing figures. What about the Taliban? The Taliban are believed to number from 20,000 to 40,000 fierce and committed fighters, about the same as a decade ago, even though Afghan forces regularly report killing more than 1,000 a month. And the Taliban are rich, with an annual budget of an estimated $2 billion. They get foreign funding from Pakistani intelligence, Qatar, Saudi sources, and probably Russia. Local funding comes from their control of the lucrative international opium and hashish trades, which employ nearly 600,000 Afghans. If we compare the anti-government forces with Afghan security forces, the Taliban are better equipped, have more resources, and have access to modern weapons. A Logar province councilman, Abdul Wali, told the New York Times, faced with the impossibility of military victory, "The Pentagon's goal has changed. We are going to drive this to a negotiated settlement," Defense Secretary James Mattis recently said. Up to now, however, the Taliban have never negotiated in good faith and have rejected the terms the U.S. has set for peace. They must renounce violence, break ties with al-Qaeda, accept the protections of women's rights in the Afghan constitution, and negotiate directly with the Afghan government. Why can't the U.S. just pull out? Because the government would surely fall. Afghanistan would once again become a Taliban-ruled medieval society, and al-Qaeda and ISIS would have free rein there to plan and carry out attacks on the U.S. The Pentagon remembers all too well that in 2011, when the U.S. pulled out of Iraq, it led to civil war and the rise of ISIS. Most experts in the region believe that negotiating with the Taliban is the only way to end the conflict, but that such negotiations must involve pressure and input from powerful neighbors, including India, China, Russia, Iran, and most of all, Pakistan. Why is Pakistan so important? To date, Pakistan has played a double game. The U.S. relies on Pakistani land and airspace to supply its troops, yet the Pakistani military also allows the Afghan Taliban to retreat into its territory. That's why Pakistan's new prime minister, Imran Khan, sworn in 2 weeks ago, could be a game changer. Khan, an ethnic Pashtun like most Taliban, is a fierce critic of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and has long advocated for negotiating with Pakistani Taliban, earning him the nickname Taliban Khan. But he has said Pakistan needs a stable Afghanistan, and the U.S. hopes Khan can nudge the Taliban to the table. Cooperation from Pakistan remains key, said U.S. General Command Chief General Joseph Votel last month. Now is the time for them to step forward. An exorbitant cost. Nearly 2,400 U.S. service personnel have been killed in the Afghan war and more than 20,000 wounded, many severely. The cost in treasure is staggering. Most estimates put it at around $4 trillion so far. But if you add in the future cost of the war veterans and their health care, as well as the interest on the money borrowed to finance the war, the figure approaches $8 trillion. Much of this money was wasted through corruption and mismanagement. John F. Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, told a Senate committee this year that the United States threw itself into reconstruction with haste and hubris, with untested assumptions and unrealistic expectations, and with piles of cash and tight deadlines for spending it. Too much, too fast, with too little oversight. By 2014, $109 billion had been spent on reconstruction alone, more in today's dollars than the entire Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe. Yet Afghanistan still lacks adequate roads, schools, and infrastructure. Opium remains the largest cash crop. The U.S. still spends $45 billion a year on Afghan security and economic aid, more than double Afghanistan's gross domestic product. We'll start into our best columns with one from the U.S. Joy Pullman at TheFederalist.com writes, a transgender studies non-PC conclusion. A Brown University researcher has come to a stunning conclusion about transgender youth, one that the university is now trying to censor, says Joy Pullman. The explosion in the number of teens, especially girls, who suddenly come to believe they are transgender, the study found, may be the result of social contagion linked to having friends who identify as transgender and obsessively viewing YouTube videos about transgender youth. Lisa Lippman, a behavioral and social sciences professor, examined clusters of rapid onset gender dysphoria among young people and surveyed 256 parents of kids who'd come out as transgender. A full 87% announced they were transgender only after friends did and or after immersing themselves in online videos and chats about transgender youth. None had expressed transgender feelings early in childhood. In one typical case, a popular coach came out as transgender, and within a year, four of her students also announced they were transgender. When activist groups strongly objected to the study, Brown yanked it off its website and apologized. But if transgenderism really is a fad, for at least some young people, that has important implications. Should parents agree to their kids' demands for irreversible surgical and hormonal intervention at an early age. This is a How They See Us column from Canada. Canada feels tricked by Trump. Canada is in a near impossible situation on NAFTA, said Barry McKenna in the Globe and Mail. U.S. President Donald Trump took office demanding renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, but rather than making deals, he has just made threats. Canada is supposed to cave to a series of hardline U.S. demands or get hit with a 25% tariff on autos that could plunge much of the country into recession. Trump says if Canada won't concede, the U.S. will make a separate side deal with the third NAFTA nation, Mexico, leaving us out. Yet the negotiations are manifestly in bad faith. In an off-the-record comment to a reporter, which was leaked last week, Trump admitted that he had no intention of compromising on anything with Ottawa, but that he couldn't say so because, in his words, it's going to be so insulting they're not going to be able to make a deal. After fuming about the leak on Twitter, he then shrugged, saying, "At least Canada knows where I stand." Indeed, we do. How can we negotiate a free trade deal with an adversary who doesn't believe in the basic principles of free trade? Trump's demands are utterly disingenuous, said Julianne Truer in Chilliwack Progress. He routinely rants about what he claims is unfair government support for the Canadian dairy industry and wants all those tariffs and subsidies removed. But Canada needs to protect this sector, which has the strictest animal welfare, milk quality, and food safety standards in the world, to ensure it's not undercut by giant U.S. agribusinesses. And guess what? The U.S. protects its own dairy industry. But while we let 10% of dairy imports come into Canada tariff-free, the U.S. waives duties on less than 3%. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has played this all wrong, said the National Post in an editorial, insisting that no NAFTA deal is better than a bad NAFTA deal. But how bad is Trump's supposed bad deal? Most Canadians would be fine with paying less for U.S. cheese and milk while saving the rest of our economy from crippling auto tariffs. It's too late now, though. Given Trump's insults, Trudeau can't accept any deal absent a major placating concession from Trump, which will never happen. Our first mistake was letting Trump turn what should have been multilateral trade negotiations into two bilateral sets of talks, said Susan Delacourt in the Toronto Star. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland keeps insisting that a win-win-win NAFTA agreement is within reach for all three parties. But that's not where we are at all. Trump pressured the Mexicans to negotiate an initial deal bilaterally, and now Canada is on its own. Whatever ends up in the deal, Trump will be the only party to have won by making Canada and Mexico fall into his isolationist, anti-multilateral way of looking at trade relations. And finally, from China, a chance to get some combat training. The Chinese military may be massive, said Minnie Chan, but its 2 million personnel are utterly inexperienced. China hasn't been at war since the late 1970s, when it fought Vietnam for a month. That makes the People's Liberation Army the only major military in the world that has not been deployed in battle in the past 4 decades. No wonder China has jumped at the chance to learn from Russia's combat experience in Syria by joining the massive Vostok 2018 war games this month. China is sending 3,200 troops and 30 aircraft to drill with Russians in Russia's far eastern Transbaikal region. Chinese tanks have already crossed the China-Russia border in Inner Mongolia. Moscow has also generously agreed to share with Chinese troops in its new military textbooks, which include the knowledge Russia gained from its crackdowns on Chechen guerrillas in the 1990s. China has a new aircraft carrier and dozens of new fighter jets, but it will need much more experience if it is to have confidence in its military might, because its officers have only presided over humanitarian missions in the odd border skirmish with India. I am retiring soon, said Lieutenant General Hay Lee. My one big regret is that I never had a chance to fight in a war. The last word feature this week is titled The Decline of the Civil War Reenactor. Legions of hobbyists donned the blue and gray in the 1980s and 90s, said Brinstow, but younger Americans are shunning the battlefield and rethinking the meaning of the war. The sun rose on the second day of the Battle of Gettysburg 2018 to reveal a line of cars parked behind the Union Army's tents. It was an annoying historical anachronism for the brigade's commander, Ted Brennan, 49, who was brushing his teeth with a horsehair toothbrush. We try to be as authentic as we can without getting dysentery, Brennan said of his unit, several of whom were frying bacon and brewing coffee over a fire. They were camped in a sea of canvas tents that housed many of the 6,000 reenactors at the event. Beyond the spectator stand and hot dog stalls, the Confederates were camped just out of sight. The 155th Gettysburg Anniversary reenactment, which was held over the second weekend in July, was a chance for dedicated hobbyists to blast away at one another with antique rifles and rekindle old friendships over campfire-cooked meals. Spectators pay $40 to watch nearly a dozen mock skirmishes over the course of 4 days, and there was an old-timey ball Saturday night, and Abraham Lincoln impersonator was on hand to pose for photos. It was also a snapshot of hobby in decline, of a hobby in decline. Gettysburg is among the biggest reenactments of the year, and it still draws thousands to its sweltering Pennsylvania countryside in the middle of summer. But that's nothing compared with the reenactments of the 1980s and 90s, when tens of thousands would turn out. In 1998, at the 135th anniversary of Gettysburg, there were an estimated 30,000 reenactors and 50,000 spectators. Many of today's reenactors were born as the last Civil War veterans were dying and grew up amid the celebrations and reenactments of the centennial that lasted from 1961 to 1965. But the heyday of reenacting was the 90s, during another moment of national fascination with the Civil War. In 1990, Ken Burns' Civil War documentary series pulled in nearly 139 million viewers, huge ratings for a PBS program, and James McPherson's 900-plus page academic book, The Battle Cry of Freedom, published in 1988, spent months on the bestseller lists. Interest in the battlefield experience of Civil War soldiers was fueled by cinematic hits like the 1989 Oscar-winning film Glory and Gettysburg, a 1993 release that was more than 4 hours long. Hundreds of reenactors were cast as extras. But in the past decade or so, the crowds at large-scale reenactments have dwindled. Longtime hobbyists are aging out and retiring. Soldiers in their 50s and 60s filled much of the camp at Gettysburg. And younger people aren't marching onto mock battlefields in nearly the same numbers. Enthusiasts cite a number of factors. Video games are to blame, some grouse, while others attribute diminishing interest to rising expense of gear. A reproduction Civil War rifle alone can cost more than $1,000. But many are more introspective about it. In the 1980s and 90s, the whole tone of the country was different, said Thomas Downs, 68, a retired machinist from Cleveland who has been reenacting for the Union side for 38 years. Up until the last 5 or 10 years, the social causes of the war did not come into what we do, he said. We were paying tribute to the fighting man. It wasn't, I'm racist and I want to glorify slavery, he said. Nobody really thought a lot about the social reasons of why the South went to war. It was just these poor guys who were underfed, undermanned, under-equipped, fighting valiantly to the last man until they couldn't stand anymore. Brad Kiefer, a 61-year-old corporal in the Union reenactor ranks and a professor of history at Kent State University, said, "Reenactors look at the war as a four-year period between 1861 and 1865, in which you can cut out all the stuff leading up to the war and very much ignore everything that happened afterward. We don't get tangled up in all the messy bits, which are the causes and outcomes, which are complicated and uncomfortable," he said. "It's a vision of history placed in narrow context. The military details are meticulously researched and recreated, down to the stitching of a uniform. But the broader social and political realities of the Civil War, the profound struggle over slavery and emancipation, racism and equality, citizenship and disenfranchisement are largely confined to the margins. Still, those issues can't be ignored. After a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, where demonstrators wore swastikas and carried Confederate flags, and where an anti-racist protester named Heather Heyer was killed, at least two smaller Civil War reenactments were canceled. That the battle flag Confederate reenactors carry is still used as a means of intimidation makes it hard to defend as a purely historical object, independent of its racist implications. You build a comfort zone for the hobby to function," Kiefer said, pointing to the Confederate camp, he said, "and give them the benefit of the doubt that they weren't at Charlottesville. There are many hardcore reenactors, the kind of people who want to know what it felt like to march 25 miles in disintegrating shoes, sleep in ditches, and subsist on hardtack and rancid salt pork, who eschew Gettysburg as a mainstream event. But at least one Union unit spent several days marching along highway shoulders to get to this year's reenactment, retracing the movements of the Army of the Potomac. Another unit traveled from Germany, and hundreds of cavalry reenactors showed up with their horses. One cavalryman, Nathaniel Williams Sr., said he grew up riding in Southern Virginia, but didn't learn that his ancestors served in the 2nd U.S. Colored Cavalry, a Union regiment of free blacks and liberated slaves, until later in life. I had no idea we were in the Civil War, said Williams, as his horse grazed in a field behind his tent. It was never taught to me. It opened up my eyes to a lot of things. Williams first organized a reenacting group about 20 years ago, recruiting relatives, friends, and members of his church. This year, about 24 people in his unit made the trip. They were the only black unit there. Black reenactors form a small faction within the overall hobby, but groups who portray U.S. colored troops, the designation the Army gave the ranks of all black regimen, tend to reenact battles where black troops played key roles in the fighting, including the Battle of Fort Wagner in South Carolina, depicted in Glory. Army commanders initially made black regiments perform menial labor and didn't regularly order them into combat until after Gettysburg. Even though we didn't fight here, we make it a family event, said Williams, sitting alongside his wife, Angela, who was wearing perioded dress. We've got 3 days. We can spend time together and have fun. The actual Battle of Gettysburg was some of the most savage fighting in the Civil War, but no one wants to die early in a reenactment. If you catch an imaginary bullet in the beginning of a skirmish, you miss out on most of the action. For the cavalry, dying in mock battle is even rarer because it means falling out of the saddle, but casualties inevitably mount. Sometimes there's just no way around it, Kiefer said. Not long after going down under intense fire from the Confederate lines, reenactors shoot gunpowder, not bullets. But serious accidents do happen from time to time. Usually it's heat stroke and heart troubles that pose the greatest threat, a problem that has grown as the average participant has aged. A Friday evening skirmish at this year's event was interrupted when an infantryman collapsed in the sun. Modern medics carted him off the field. The fighting was over when the buglers sounded taps. The soldiers placed their caps over their hearts, shook hands, and congratulated one another on a good fight. Historical flourishes and stacked rifles aside, the camp at a Civil War reenactment resembles a Boy Scout jamboree. The slice of rustic outdoor life is one of the hobby's big draws. I tell people it's a chance to have a guy's weekend out camping, just doing it a little more old school than people are used to, said Christopher Wesp, 34, a relatively recent recruit and former Marine who served three tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. From my first event, the camaraderie that I felt and started building was very close and comparable to what it was like being in the service, he said. That's the thing I missed most about being in the Marine Corps. Politically, Civil War reenactors tend to be conservative, perhaps a reflection of the demographics of a hobby that skews heavily white and middle-aged. But it's not a monolith. One Union infantryman, a 20-year-old college student, described himself as a Marxist and card-carrying member of the International Workers of the World. Most reenactors have strong preferences, but few stick exclusively to one side, instead switching into Confederate or Union garb if the opposing ranks are too thin. Still, some Union reenactors said they chose to wear blue at least in part because of their political convictions or because they wouldn't fight against the U.S. flag. The Confederates were more likely to say family history had a role in how they picked their side. I've been called a racist, a bigot, everything you could think of in the world when people find out I do this, said Kenny Glass, 46, from Selma, Alabama. I tell them they need to learn their history. It wasn't fought over slavery. It was fought over Southern rights. That's just the way I see it. Don King, a Confederate reenactor who grew up in North Carolina and now lives near Sykesville, Maryland, disagreed. The South fought the war because of slavery, he said, but you can't fight a battle with only one side. Think of what a Star Wars movie would be without the Empire, he said. Just because you're acting on one side doesn't mean you embrace their historical beliefs. Part of the problem is that historical beliefs have modern-day implications. Scrutiny of Civil War reenacting from the outside, as well as introspection and concern about its future on the inside, reached a fever pitch after the violence last year in Charlottesville. But it built along with protests in many cities that demanded the removal of Confederate statues and monuments from state grounds, spurred by the murder of 9 black worshipers in Charleston, South Carolina, by white supremacist Dylann Roof. Recently, threats against reenactors have disrupted several events. In October, police in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia discovered a suspicious device, possibly a pipe bomb, amid the concession stands at the annual Cedar Creek reenactment. A month later, a threat was made against participants in a parade that commemorates Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Those incidents cast a shadow over Gettysburg this year. Word trickled out that Cedar Creek had been canceled entirely, and while the reason was not stated, many thought it was obvious. Who would mess with Civil War reenactors, said Downs, the retired machinist from Cleveland. We're just a bunch of nutcases running around playing cowboys and Indians. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read a couple of the health and science short pieces this week. First, why extreme weather stalls in place. Scientists say they have established why vast swaths of the northern hemisphere were besieged by extreme heat waves and prolonged drought over the summer, and warn that these extreme extremes are only going to get worse. Large areas of Europe, North America, and Asia endured record temperatures in July and August, with wildfires breaking out as far north as the Arctic Circle. Researchers examined the links between the summer's weather and Arctic warming, where climate change is causing temperatures to rise between 2 and 4 times faster than the global average. They concluded that the narrowing temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator is preventing planetary winds from building up enough energy to push high and low pressure systems around. The weather in a given region gets stuck, co-author Hans Joachim Schnellhuber of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research tells The Independent. Rains can grow into floods, sunny days into heat waves, and tender dry conditions into wildfires. Another prominent example of this stalling phenomenon was last year's Hurricane Harvey, which dumped record volumes of water on Texas after getting stuck on the coast and drawing up massive amounts of moisture from the sea. The researchers warn that stalling weather patterns could imperil food production in Europe, Russia, and the U.S. The health scare of the week, breastfeeding and marijuana. Now that marijuana has become legal for recreational use in 8 states and for medical use in 30, a growing number of people consider the drug largely harmless. But the American Academy of Pediatrics has a simple message for nursing mothers. Don't touch the stuff. The AAP examined 50 mothers who used marijuana, with children ranging from newborn to toddlers more than a year old, reported CNN.com. The researchers found that tetrahydrocannabinol, the psychoactive ingredient in weed known as THC, could be detected in breast milk up to 6 days after use of the drug. While previous research has suggested that THC can cross to the fetus via the placenta, potentially affecting brain development, the AAP study didn't look into how or whether the milk's recipient could be affected. But the researchers concluded that until more is known, taking the drug while breastfeeding simply isn't worth the risk. Study author Christina Chambers from the University of California, San Diego, said the findings should be a call to action for long-term research. And on the Talking Points page, we'll start with an article titled, Labor, the State of the American Worker. 2 labor days into Donald Trump's presidency, what has happened to the working class? Asked E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. Trump campaigned as a populist who would fight for America's forgotten men and women. But since taking office, he's done little for wage earners. Real hourly wages actually dropped between July 2017 and July 2018, with a paltry wage gain of 2.7%, completely wiped out by higher inflation. Meanwhile, Trump and the Republican Congress have showered benefits on the wealthiest segments of society with a $1.5 trillion tax cut. By virtually any yardstick, the U.S. economy is doing great, said David Lazarus in the Los Angeles Times. But a booming stock market and record corporate profits haven't translated into gains for ordinary workers. Under Trump, corporations have received 11 times more in tax cuts than they've paid in bonuses and wage hikes. Much of the wealth now being created is landing in the laps of the 1% and not trickling down any further. If things are so terrible for workers, asked Matthew Continetti in FreeBeacon.com, why do they still support Trump? A new Harvard-Harris poll shows that 85% of blue-collar workers say their lives are headed in the right direction. That makes sense with the GDP forecast to grow a robust 3% this year. Trump deserves some credit. His pro-business attitude stirs the bull's animal spirits. He also let rural and small-town Americans know that their economic and cultural concerns mattered, said Gary Bauer in WashingtonExaminer.com. Trump saw them and gave them the respect they deserved. Don't expect Democrats to do much for these people, said Joel Kotkin in the Orange County, California Register. It used to be the party of the middle class, but now it's beholden to the socially liberal technology moguls and Wall Street financiers pouring money into the Democratic Party's coffers. These tech and financial elites rely on vast armies of underpaid laborers and contract workers. As a result, they believe in a kind of oligarchical socialism in which a small elite will inevitably enjoy most of the country's economic wealth. The rest will subsist on part-time gig work with government handouts such as a guaranteed income and national health care, keeping the populist pitchforks away. Americans would be saved from abject poverty only to watch their children devolve into serfs. Second article, Florida, a bellwether race for governor. The fate of Donald Trump will be the big story of November's midterm election, said David Linehart in the New York Times. But one of the most fascinating subplots is the race to be Florida's next governor. In this perennial swing state, Republicans have nominated Ron DeSantis, 39, a telegenic right-winger so outlandishly pro-Trump that one campaign ad has him reading aloud to his four-month-old son from Trump's Art of the Deal. Democrats, meanwhile, have nominated Andrew Gillum, also 39, the Bernie Sanders-endorsed progressive mayor of Tallahassee, who wants to replace ICE with a more humane agency, raise taxes on corporations, and institute Medicare for all. Gillum achieved his shock victory. He was polling fourth on primary day by mobilizing African-American and millennial voters, said L. Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com, especially those who rallied behind Sanders in 2016. If Gillum can pull off this trick again and win in November, Democrats will likely conclude that unapologetic progressivism is the secret sauce they need to take back the White House in 2020. Not only is Gillum too far left for most Florida voters, said NationalReview.com in an editorial, his record as Tallahassee's mayor is far from sparkling. There are troubling questions swirling about his involvement in a corruption scandal involving shady lobbyists and real estate deals. DeSantis has his own more recent problems, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. In an interview last week with Fox News, he urged Florida voters not to monkey this up by electing Black Gillum. The racial subtext of DeSantis' remarks was so overt that even Fox issued a mild condemnation. If DeSantis builds his campaign around this kind of Trumpian race baiting, it will cost him the moderates he needs to win. Republicans underestimate Gillum at their peril, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Unlike Sanders, Gillum avoids the rhetoric of great ideological battles and sells his policies on health care, taxes, and education as pragmatic and solutions-oriented. DeSantis, similarly, isn't quite the wild-eyed Trumper he plays on Fox News, said WashingtonExaminer.com. He's a Trumpian populist, yes, but also a true believer in free market, small government philosophy of the pre-Trump GOP. The matchup of these two young candidates, who each offer blueprints for their party's future, makes the Florida governor's race the most important contest to watch in 2018. And a few short notes as we finish up the show today. The average price of a 2019 health insurance policy sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges is expected to increase less than 4% this year, much less than in previous years, as the ACA marketplace stabilized despite active opposition by the Trump administration. Premiums in several states are actually falling. About 47% of millennials have at least one tattoo, compared with 13% of baby boomers. The tattoo industry generated $1.6 billion in revenue last year and is expected to continue to grow at the rate of 7.7% a year. More than 14% of the U.S. population in 2016 was foreign-born, the highest level of immigrants in the U.S. since the turn of the 20th century. Supreme Court justices confirmed before 1800 lived to an average age of 67 years old, while those confirmed between 1950 and 1974 lived to almost 82. And we'll finish out with a quote from Gustave Flaubert, quoted in the Rolling Stone. It's interesting, but I'm still trying to figure it out. He says, "Be regular and orderly in your life, so you may be violent and original in your work." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. Number's 919-832-5138.